This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Emily Blunt stars as Mary Poppins in the new film Mary Poppins Returns, a Disney musical sequel to the beloved 1964 film which starred Julie Andrews and was adapted from the 1934 P.L. Travers novel. Blunt is nominated for a Golden Globe and an award from SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, for her performance. Emily Blunt is known for her roles in The Devil Wears Prada, Looper, Sicario, The Girl on the Train, the film adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, and the horror film A Quiet Place, which was directed by her husband, John Krasinski, who also starred opposite her, playing her husband. In Mary Poppins Returns, the two children she helped raise in the first story, Jane and Michael Banks, are now adults. Michael is a single father, still mourning the loss of his wife a year after her death. His three young children desperately miss their mother. It's Depression-era London, and times are hard. Michael is an artist, unable to support his children with his art, so he's taken a temporary job as a bank teller. But the bank is about to foreclose on the family's home, the same house the bank's children grew up in. The bank's family needs a miracle. And they kind of get one when Mary Poppins comes floating back down from the sky to become the children's new nanny. The adult Jane and Michael are astonished and confused when they see her. Here's Ben Whishaw as Michael, Emily Mortimer as Jane, and Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins!
Close your mouth, please, Michael. We are still not a codfish. Jane Banks. Still rather inclined to giggle, I see.
Good heavens. It really is you.
You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? How incredibly rude. One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I taught you better.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
You came back. I thought we'd never see you again.
It is wonderful to see you.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Emily Blunt, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on Mary Poppins Returns.
Thank you.
I'm going to start by asking you what everybody is asking you, I'm sure. How old were you when you saw the original film and what did
it
mean to you?
I'm sure it was about 5 or 6, and I think like most of the world, it was probably one of the first films that I ever saw and was spellbound by it. And I remember elements of it so clearly, you know, the Jolly Holiday sequence where I couldn't believe that people could dance with cartoons, you know, it was like incredible to me. And most profoundly, I remember, maybe because she is a bit of a disciplinarian, the idea of feeling very safe in her hands as a child, that she was going to come in and sweep it all up and make everything right again in a very sure-handed way. And I remember just feeling safe with her, you know, with the groundedness of her, but and the magic.
Did you read the Mary Poppins books?
Well, I didn't as a child, but I did leading up to playing my version of her. In fact, I didn't watch the original again right before I played her. I just chose to, you know, have my, you know, a few memories of it from watching it as a child, but I didn't want to sort of get compromised by the details of what Julie Andrews did so beautifully. I knew it was going to be my version of her, so I did very much dive into the books where she is rather different, sort of rather eccentric and batty and very rude and vain. And so that's that. The books became a very evocative source for this new version of her for me.
Let me read a couple of lines from the original Mary Poppins book. Jane and Michael could see that the newcomer had shiny black hair, rather like a wooden Dutch doll, whispered Jane, and that she was thin, with large feet and hands and small, rather peering blue eyes. You know, people know Just a Spoonful of Sugar, where Mary Poppins sings about how to sweeten the medicine and to help the medicine go down. So in the book, Mary Poppins is holding out medicine and it says, Michael suddenly discovered that you could not look at Mary Poppins and disobey her. There was something strange and extraordinary about her, something that was frightening and at the same time, most exciting. So, you know, you talk about how you took, like, the disciplinarian part of her. You portray her, and she's this way in the book, as so proper and such a disciplinarian. But she has this other magical side. Like every time she's the proper disciplinarian, there's always this implicit or explicit wink that's going on. And I was wondering if you could talk about playing both sides of her character.
Sure. I mean, I think that that's what excited me about her is the duality of her. And certainly when P.L. Travers wrote her, you know, everyone would talk to P.L. Travers about how magical she is and how fantastical she is and how supernatural she is. And she said, well, I don't think she is at all. I think she is reality. I think she's very, very real. And she talks about her. She described her. She just said, in order to fly, you need something very solid to take off from. And I think that's how I see her. She is practical and yet fantastical and fastidious and yet really eccentric. And she doesn't really reveal her inner workings to anybody. I think she rather likes that she's a mystery. She takes a lot of joy in that no one can figure her out.
And every time a magical episode is over, in the books, Mary Poppins denies that it ever happened.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and maybe that's the form of true generosity, to give so much and to recognize what people need and give it to them and expect absolutely nothing in return, in fact, to not even take credit for it. And I think maybe for me with the character, she connects so deeply. She's all about that, about connectivity with people. But yet she holds at arm's length. And I've always felt personally it's because she will inevitably have to leave. It's maybe her way of coping with that.
You play that at the end. I mean, I could see the sadness on your face. When
she loves the banks. Yeah, I think it's very hard.
Yeah, and she's alone in the sky. I mean, she doesn't have a family.
She
and she's never going to, I don't think.
No.
So because
I mean, I think she likes flirting around with many laborers, but I don't think she has a special man in her life, you know.
You know, because she is so proper, you know, she has a very proper accent, and it's not the accent that you're speaking to us with now.
No.
Did you have to learn the Mary Poppins proper accent for the part?
I mean, it's not that I had to sort of do dialect lessons, you know. I mean, I can do various different accents from England, you know. It just makes me laugh that Mary Poppins is even posher than my mother, which I can't quite believe, you know.
But, is your mother posh?
She is very posh, yes. So is my dad, you know. They speak beautifully, but I think for Mary Poppins, it needed to be a pretty exaggerated version of that because of her imperious nature. But also she should sound practically perfect. And also it's set in the 30s, which was a very specific sound. And so funnily enough, I listened to Princess Margaret quite a lot for how she spoke. And then I just sort of winged it.
Can you say a few words with that proper accent? can you answer the next question with that accent? Here's one that would set you up perfectly. There's, you know, several Mary Poppins-isms, and one of them is, now spit spot into bed.
Well, Terry, my absolute favorite would have to be Pish Posh. I just think it's a wonderful way of just shutting everything down.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Now, are those real Britishisms, spit spot and Pish Posh? Or are those like Mary Poppins expressions?
I think they are. I mean, I think that P.L. Travers actually heard her auntie say spit spot and off to bed. So I think she took it from that. But I think they have quickly... I don't think I ever heard anyone say pish posh until I read the Mary Poppins books. It is my favorite phrase that she has, is pish posh.
So you said that your mother has a very posh accent. She teaches English as a second language, right?
Yes.
So does she teach that very posh way of pronouncing to her students?
Well, I think it's just the way she speaks. She just has a beautiful speaking voice. So does my dad. My dad sounds like Richard Burton. I mean, my dad, even on my wedding day, took great pride that he didn't need a microphone for his speech. He just knew how to project, you know. Everyone else was using a microphone, and Dad was like, no, I don't need that.
So what was floating down from the sky like for you?
Well, quite terrifying, I think. I mean, I thought I was all right with heights. And then as they winch you past 30 feet, 40 feet, 50 feet, you're suddenly at 60 feet. And you realize you're terrible with heights. And Lin-Manuel Miranda was like the size of a pea suddenly. and I found the easiest thing to do when I was that high was just to look upwards to the sky, because then I had no frame of reference for just how high I was, because I was at that point above the trees and Lynn was tiny. And I thought for a second, this might be how I go. This is how I go, dressed as Mary Poppins.
Oh, no. Were you really thinking that?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, because it's just one wire. And you're thinking, well, who's holding the wire? And do I know them even? And, you know, it's just you literally have your life in a burly stuntman's hands.
No, silly me. I was imagining that it was kind of some kind of rear projection and that you didn't have to float that much.
No. I mean, Rob Marshall, the director, very much wanted to do everything as practically as possible. So as much as possible, it was us in the air on wires. And I don't think I was alone. I think a few of my co-stars were quite scared of heights as well.
And you were wearing high heels.
Yes. Exactly.
Like if you had a crash land, that would not have been good.
Yes. No, not good. I mean, that was one of the scariest stunts we did. We're doing this fantastic number through the streets of London that Lin-Manuel Miranda has. It's a huge show-stopping Hollywood number called Trip a Little Light Fantastic. And we have to dance along the top of a narrow wall and then jump off the wall out of shot. And we land on a crash mat. But you're wearing heels. And so I thought, well, and my stunt woman tried it for me first and twisted her ankle.
Oh,
I think
gosh.
Yeah, she was in a boot for the rest of the shoot. So, yeah, it was just all Mission Impossible doing Mary Poppins, you see.
But you did the stunt anyway?
I did do it, but only a couple of times. And then I said, Rob, I think I don't want to do it anymore.
Okay. Let's hear you sing. You know, I heard you sing first in the film adaptation of Into the Woods, the Stephen Sondheim mm-hmm. musical, which was adapted for the screen by Rob Marshall, who also directed Mary Poppins Returns. And he's so good with musicals. I mean, he also did Chicago.
Oh, he's extraordinary. I mean, I think he is the only man for this impossible job of taking on the next chapter of Mary Poppins.
Yeah, it's very hard to do musicals on film, I think.
It's
somehow easier on stage. I'm not exactly sure why. Maybe because stage, there's nothing, it's not realism, whereas in movies, you're kind of expected to see some sort of realism, though that's not even true since there's so many superheroes and sci-fi and everything.
No, you're exactly right. But I think the thing about film is that everything gets terribly intimate and you are sucked into a world that has a sense of realism. You're not in that proscenium arch nature of watching a performance on stage, and I think that's his great skill, is making sure that it's not sort of embarrassing when people break into song. It can very often be like, oh God, why are they singing, you know?
Well, in this film, he really has a knack, he and the composer Mark Shaiman and the lyricist Scott Whitman, for kind of talking into songs. So like,
absolutely,
you talk your way into the songs, you know, the character of Michael, the father, talks his way into his song. And we're going to hear an example of that in the song I'm going to play. It is a song I really like. It's called Can You Imagine That? And this is your first, it's like your first day with the kids. And they've been they're all really dirty and you're preparing a bath. None of them want to take a bath. But you put these like magic bubbles in the bath and then you're taking out, you know, all these magical things, all these magical toys from your famous carpet bag.
Yes.
Throwing them into the tub and then even more magic happens. But anyways, as you're doing all of this, you're singing this song, Can You Imagine That?, as you're talking to the kids. So here's my guest, Emily Blunt, from the soundtrack of Mary Poppins Returns.
John, you're right. It's good to know you're bright, for intellect can wash away confusion. George sees, and Annabelle agrees. Most folderols an optical illusion. You three know it's true that 1 + 1 = 2. Yes, logic is the rock of our foundation. I suspect, and I'm never incorrect, that you're far too old to give in to imagination. No, not yet. Some people like to splash and play. Can you imagine that? And take a seaside holiday. Can you imagine that? Too much glee leaves rings around the brain. Take that joy and send it down the drain. Some people like to laugh at life and giggle through the day. They think the world's a brand new shiny toy.
And if while dreaming in the clouds they fall and go kersplat, although they're down and bent in half, they brush right off and start to laugh. Can you imagine that?
On second thoughts, so that's my guest, right. Emily Blunt, from the soundtrack of Mary Poppins Returns. So, as I said, you'd already sung in Into the Woods. And Rob Marshall has said that he likes to work with actors who can sing as opposed to singers who can act. And yes. I know he's hired voice teachers. Like for Chicago, he had a voice coach working with the actors who didn't know how to sing or hadn't at least sung in front of a camera or on stage. Did you get any kind of singing coaching for this role?
Yes, I mean, I worked with Eric Vitro on Into the Woods, and then I worked with Joan Leda and Eric Vitro on Mary Poppins. And it's sort of essential, actually, for me, because I have not been trained as a singer, and they do give you the sort of confidence and the tools to assist you. I mean, I think it was easier for me with Mary Poppins. I mean, Stephen Sondheim, his music sort of requires all of you. It is some of the most, it is the deep end of musical theatre. But Mary Poppins, for me, was a more slow burn, tailor-made experience, because the songs were written with me in mind, with my abilities in mind. And the songwriters and composers, they really learnt my voice and what I could do and what I couldn't do. And so by the time I started singing them on set, I mean, I'd been working with this music for, you know, over a year by that point.
So you were cast before the songs were written?
Yes. Huh. Yeah, I was cast. I mean, Rob called me in August 2015. We didn't start shooting till February 2017. So it was the longest attachment to one project of my life, really.
So what did you learn about your voice or about singing for this film that you didn't
that
already
know?
That
I got better. That I had a better range than I thought, probably. I mean, that I think it can, you know, that I shouldn't be intimidated right off the bat with a song, because you can improve so much. You can get so much better the more you sing it, and it just gets in your blood. And then the other thing, great thing I've learned from working with Rob Marshall, I remember this when I auditioned for Into the Woods, which I went into that room, my knees knocking. I just have always loathed singing in front of people. I really like doing it privately, but just not in front of people. And I went in to audition, and I said, Rob, I'm very, very nervous. I said, I don't like singing in front of people. And he said, I'm not, as you say, he said, I'm not interested in singers who can kind of act. I want actors who can kind of sing. And he said, so I just want you to tell me a story and stop worrying about making it sound pretty, but tell me your story as this character. And that's, I think, what I learned, is that I think the singers that we all respond to and fall in love with are the ones that evoke a story and the ones that make you feel something. It's not just about listening to vocal gymnastics. It's about telling a story that moves people. So that's sort of what I tend to focus on now and not worry about how it sounds. And it always sounds better if I stop worrying about how it sounds.
So in the song we just heard, where you basically talk your way into the song.
Yes.
Does that make it any easier or more difficult to sing? You know,
like No. I think it's more seamless. And I think that what Rob Marshall tends to do when he works is you rehearse for 9 weeks. So we had a long rehearsal period, so we knew what we would be doing when we sang the songs. So then you go and pre-record them, and I pre-recorded them with like a 100-piece orchestra, one of the best days of my life, so moving and wonderful. So then on the day of shooting, when you shoot the musical numbers, you have a perfect pre-record that he'll blast from the speakers. So you'll do a few takes like that, and then there'll be that hideous moment where he says, okay, we're going to do one live. And you just think, oh my God. And then you put the little earwig in your ear, and you are the only one on set who can hear the music. Everyone else is listening to some probably like subpar a cappella version of the song, which is so humiliating. But I think what you then get is this beautiful blend, so that there is a lovely seamless quality from the scene into the song, so that the songs become an extension of the scene.
So there's a blend of you singing live, so to speak, with the pre-record?
Correct. So the ballad I sing to the children, which is another number, was nearly all live, actually, just because of the sense of intimacy that the song has. That was predominantly live, I think.
So when you were a child, you had a stutter. How bad was it, and how did it affect your childhood?
It was very bad. It got progressively worse. It was not so bad when I was younger. By the time I was sort of 12, 13, it was probably at its peak. And it is, and it was, and still is for many people who suffer with it. It is a condition that people sort of tease because you sound funny and you look funny when you stutter. You're trying to force words out so everything contorts and you can sometimes look like a crazy person, you know. And it's a misrepresentation of who you are. It's just an inability to speak. And so I work a lot with kids who stutter and adults who stutter. And it's hard when you're in the thick of it because you think it's going to be your whole life. And it's not. It doesn't have to be. If you get the right treatment, it's very temporary. You can manage it. You can very much manage it. You just need to get the right help. But it did affect me. I mean, I did become less verbose, literally, and didn't want to speak as much, just because I was embarrassed. But I was also embarrassed for people who were talking to me because they don't know what to do. Some people would just be, I had this awful teacher who just said, just say it, just spit it out. You know, people don't understand it. They don't understand why you can't speak. Kids don't understand why you can't speak. And there's not enough information out there about it. And it's very common. It's very, very common.
When a teacher would say it, just spit it out, would that make it worse?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, one time I just actually walked away from her because I needed to go to the bathroom and I couldn't say I need to go to the bathroom. So I ended up just turning around and walking out the door.
Were you punished for
that? To hear her going, where are you going? And I wrote it down. I wrote it down. I said I had to go to the bathroom and I couldn't tell you. And then she felt quite bad, I think. And then my mum had to come in and have a word.
Yeah. So you said it got worse until you were like 12 or 13. Why do you think it got worse with time instead of better until that point?
Well, I think it's a skipping record, and then as soon as you associate yourself with somebody who stutters and that's the stamp that you put on yourself, then it sort of solidifies it in some ways. It's sort of like people who, I don't know, put some label on an illness that they have, and the illness suddenly intensifies as soon as it's labeled. And so I think that probably is what happened. But then I did grow out of mine, and I think a lot of it was to do with this extraordinary teacher I had who encouraged me to do a class play. And I said, I don't want to. And he said, I think you're very funny. And I think that you are very good at voices. You do silly voices and you don't stutter when you do a silly voice. So why don't you do a silly accent or something? That's probably why I've always been really fascinated by changing my voice depending on the role. And because it was a way of unlocking me. And I have to credit him as somebody who's not a stutterer for understanding that idea of sort of removing yourself from yourself so that you can speak fluently. And it was one of the first times doing a stupid Northern English accent that I could speak fluently.
So was it a kind of slow change, losing your stutter, or was it slow?
Yes, it was slow. It wasn't like night and day. It wasn't like this sort of big reveal that suddenly I speak fluently, but it certainly gives you the confidence to know that you can. And so much of life and overcoming life setbacks is about confidence. It's really so much about that. And weirdly, you know, I have met a lot of actors that I've worked with, and then through the work I've done with the American Institute of Stuttering, which is the most extraordinary organization to help people with stutters, but I've met a lot of actors who stutter and still stutter, but don't when they perform. So I think there is definitely something to that removal of yourself, and it allows for a more fluent way of speaking. So many actors I've met and worked with used to or still do.
Have you thought about how much of stuttering is physiological, like the muscle seizing, and how much of it is the brain, like the brain not communicating to the vocal cords and the jaw muscles in enough time so that, like, you're speaking before your brain has fully communicated what you're supposed to be saying.
No, it's not that. It's not that you don't know what you want to say. It's that you know completely clearly what you want to say. It's actually hereditary stuttering. So it runs quite prominently in my family, and you'll usually find with most stutterers that it runs in their family in some way. But it's nothing to do really with the brain not being able to communicate what you want to say. It is a muscular issue, and so I guess it's a synaptic signal that happens, that there's a kind of misfire there. It's quite hard to explain, really.
So you were signed by an agent while you were still in school. Does that mean high school or college?
It's what I call college, which is between the age of 16 and 18, so I guess that's still high school for you guys. So I was 17 when I got an agent. I was at the Edinburgh Fringe Theatre Festival, and I did a play through my school. I had this really great school that had a great drama department, and they said, you want to do a play this summer and earn some money? I thought, yeah, great. And so I did, and an agent came to see it, and he said, well, I think you should give this a go. And not that I entered into the industry feeling cavalier about it. I just, because it had not been my intention, I didn't enter into it with a burning ambition for anything miraculous to happen. And that probably served me quite well, because then I always really enjoyed auditioning for things. I didn't feel nervous doing it, because I didn't have any stakes, really. The stakes were low for me.
Because you weren't passionate about acting, that wasn't like...
Well, that wasn't going to be my life decision to do that. So I think I just approached it rather shoulder shruggingly, thinking I'll just give this a go. I actually wanted to go and learn Spanish at university and be a translator for the UN. I was really excited to do something with languages. My mother is also an amazing linguist, so I was sort of inspired by her.
Well, you've done something with languages. It's just not like speaking them.
Exactly.
Were you initially shy about being on stage?
No. I don't think so. I mean, I was scared. I'll never, ever forget the first time I went on stage in front of the public. It was my first job, and I was 18, and I was in a play in the West End. And I just was sweating bullets. I was so frightened. I felt like I was 10 paces behind myself trying to catch up all night. Outer body, literally outer body experience. I'll never forget that feeling. And it's never quite been so bad since, other than when I did Saturday Night Live, which I thought I was going to die from a heart attack and fear. I couldn't stay. Oh, I was terrified.
Had you watched Saturday Night Live when you were growing up in England?
Yes. Not as much as people do here, but I'd seen some of it. But I just remember standing behind those doors and this wonderful woman, Donna, who sort of, you know, just wrenches you around the set, putting different wigs on you all night in the fast changes that you do. But she stood behind me, and I saw there was a puke bucket next to the door.
Seriously?
And she said, you'd be surprised how many people upchuck into that before they get pushed through the door. Oh, I remember her rubbing my back, just saying, everything's fine, you're okay, everything's fine. And then the doors open, and I was like, oh my God. So frightened.
Well, there's an image I never had in my head before.
Yeah. There you go. Just now you have to imagine who's thrown up before they go on SNL.
That's an interesting game to play, an interesting mental game
yes.
to play. So I think your breakthrough movie role was The Devil Wears Prada, in which...
Yes, I'm sure.
You,
No one's seen that movie.
No one's seen that. So for anyone who hasn't seen it, I mean, it's set at this like high fashion magazine kind of Vogue. Is that... Mm-hmm. Fair to say?
Correct.
Yeah, and Meryl Streep plays the editor-in-chief, kind of.
Yes.
Why am I blanking on her name?
Anna Wintour.
Anna Wintour, yes.
Yes. Although Meryl didn't actually base it on Anna Wintour.
Well,
she told Anna that. She based it on two men in Hollywood that she knew, who will remain nameless, but I know who they are.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
She's so kind of like... fetch this and get me that and do this and that's not good enough. And everybody's kind of terrified of her, and they kind of hate her, and they live two lives, when she's present and they're doing things because she's there, and the other when she's out and they're more like themselves. But anyways, you're her assistant and she's a tyrant. How did you get the part?
I had to audition for it, and I remember... I was out in LA, which I found altogether overwhelming anyway, because it was very new and I was 22, I think. And I was auditioning at Fox Studios for something else. And then they just threw these sides at me and they said, actually, would you just read for this other thing while you're here? Can you just read for it? It's called The Devil Wears Prada. And I think I remember feeling really nervous because I was going to miss my flight. And so I think because of the anxiety I probably felt about being late, which I loathe being late in general, I think in some ways that worked because I had a sense of, I had a sort of fretful energy about me anyway. And that rather worked for this anxious, fractious, starving assistant that I was playing.
Cause, yes, because she's always in a hurry. And everything
always
needed to be done 5 minutes ago, so yeah.
That's it. And she's just desperate and lives, completely defines herself by this job that she does and the clothes that she wears. And she's really funny, really, really funny character, just completely idiotic in many ways.
So that was the first time you've worked with Meryl Streep.
Yes.
And you've worked with her twice since in Into the Woods.
Yes.
And of course, now you have a big scene, a very funny scene with her in Mary
yes.
Poppins Returns. She's supposed to be intimidating in her character as the editor
yes.
of the magazine. Did that carry over on set?
Right. I mean, I was more intimidated because I was very young and it was sort of my first big film. I think I'd done one film before that. And she sort of stayed in a bit of a midway point throughout the day, you know, when it comes to the character and who she is in real life. She sort of, I think she very much kept herself to herself on The Devil Wears Prada. And I found out afterwards that, because I learned so much about her after the film, how gregarious and warm, loving she is, that I think that character was quite hard for her because we'd all be having a party on the other side of the set and she would be sort of reading a book in the corner trying to stay focused and severe, you know, as this character. And then I really got to know her afterwards. John worked with her and he had a fabulous time. And then I worked with her on Into the Woods and then again, she played my insane cousin Topsy. And I do find it funny that Meryl and I, in every film we've done, we've played characters who are a bit contentious with each other. And I'm just like, when can we play sort of lovers or friends, at least? Even friends, you know. I'm sort of waiting for the day.
So what's the difference between how you were dressing at the time you made The Devil Wears Prada and how your character at the high fashion runway magazine was dressing?
Oh, God, I'm sure I was wearing probably some ill-fitting jeans and some bad shoes and probably a top that was too low-cut, probably some obvious top. So I learned quite a lot through Patricia Field about fashion and about how brave you should be and how artistic it can be. And I really love it now, I think probably because I tend to dress a bit like a teenage boy every day of my normal life. And then, you know, I get dressed up for these red carpets and the press junkets and I really enjoy it because it's such fun. I find the style part of it very artistic and very exciting and because it's so not me, it's so not how I dress. I mean, my children, even if I put on some makeup, they're like, where are you going? It's like, I think they would prefer me just to be in sweatpants and high top trainers all the time. That's how they want to see me.
So in Into the Woods, which is a Stephen Sondheim musical that's
yeah.
kind of a mashup of different fairy tales. But, you know, it's pretty dark.
Yeah.
So you, in the film adaptation directed by Rob Marshall, who also directed Mary Poppins Returns, you play the baker's wife. And that's how she's described in the film, as the baker's wife.
Yes.
I'm not trying to be sexist here.
It's okay.
You are just the wife of the baker.
I'm the wife of the baker, and he's the baker.
He's the baker. So Meryl Streep plays this kind of like wicked witch kind of figure who's put a
yeah.
curse on your house. And this
you
curse.
See? Contentious.
Yes.
Contentious
she's
woman.
That kind of person. and this is what is preventing you and your husband, the baker, played by James
yes.
Corden. This is what is preventing you from conceiving and having a child. And you desperately want a child.
Yes.
So the witch, Meryl Streep, makes it clear that the way to dispel the curse, to lift the curse, is that you have to bring her three totally improbable things that you can fetch from the woods, one of them being like a milky white cow.
Yes, it's four things. It's a milky white cow, hair as yellow as corn, a cape as red as blood and a slipper as pure as gold. I was just trying to remember if I had those straight. Yes.
So your husband,
and a cow as might as milk.
So your husband, the baker, sets off to the woods by himself to find these things. And you say, I'm going with you. And
sure.
He says, I can do it on my own. But you go anyways. You meet him there and you're incredibly helpful. And this song comes when he realizes he couldn't have done what he's been doing without you. And the song is called It Takes Two. And you realize in the beginning of the song that he's become more brave and more interesting during this adventure in the woods looking for these things to fulfill the witch's needs.
Yes.
So here is my guest Emily Blunt along with James Corden from the soundtrack of the Stephen Sondheim musical, the film adaptation, Into the Woods.
You've changed. You're daring. You're different in the woods. More sure, more sharing. You're getting us through the woods. If you could see, you're not the man who started, and much more open-hearted than I knew you to be.
It takes two. I thought one was enough, it's not true. It takes two of us, you came through. When the journey was rough, it took you. It took two of us, it takes care. It takes patience and fear and despair to change. Though you swear to change, you can tell if you do. It takes two.
You've changed. You're thriving. There's something about the woods. Not just surviving. You're blossoming in the woods. At home, I'd fear we'd stay the same forever. And then, out here, your passion, a charming, consider a clever...
It takes one to begin, but then once you've begun, it takes two of you, it's no fun. But what needs to be done, you can do. When there's two of you, if I tear, it's because I'm becoming aware of us. As a pair of us, each accepting a share of what's there.
We've changed. We're strangers. I'm meeting you in the woods.
That's my guest Emily Blunt with James Corden from the soundtrack of the film adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's musical Into the Woods. So I don't know when the last time you heard that was, Emily Blunt, but how does it sound to you?
I think it sounds all right.
It sounds great to me. I love
good
the film. Did you get to
meet? I love that song. I think it's such a beautiful song and such a sort of bonding moment for the two of them who sort of tend to bicker and be at odds with one another. And I found the whole sequence singing that with him very funny and very romantic. And I absolutely adore working with James. He's just the best. Crazy funny. Just so exciting to work with.
Did you meet Stephen Sondheim in preparation for the movie? What did he tell you? Did he give you any advice or insights that were really helpful, either as a singer or portraying the character?
He was in the recording studio, which we were all terribly intimidated by. My husband John was there when I was recording It Takes Two with James, and he said that Stephen Sondheim loved it and was sort of having his arms in the air and was just sort of like floating along, listening to it. And the song finished and apparently he just went, oh, that was fabulous. And so that made me feel good. And then I recorded another song and he came in and he was like, I think you're just thinking about it too much. I think you need to like be right on the beat. You need to be right on it. You're like dragging it. And I was like, I'm so sorry, Stephen Sondheim. It went from thinking I could do no wrong to really disappointing him. He was like, you're just letting it drag. Just stop overthinking it, you know.
Well, I guess he's honest, huh?
It speaks his mind. I'll take it. His song. He should be.
Yeah, which song was that?
Moments in the Woods.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you change after that?
I just listened to it. I stopped dragging it, probably. Stayed right on the beat.
Did it deflate your confidence?
No. I like the notes and the criticism. I think it's good. It kind of, you know, stirs you up a bit. You got to find a different approach.
So with Mary Poppins Returns, your new film, have you seen it with an audience?
I have seen it once with an audience, and I thought it was just an overwhelmingly wonderful experience, actually, because you sort of rediscover it through their eyes, and the energy and the joy in the room was palpable and terribly exciting.
You know, it's funny, like for me, I was just like a few years too old to see it as a child. So, mm-hmm. and I was at that age where like you've just become not a child anymore. Like I was maybe, did it come out in 1964, the original?
Yes, it did. Yeah.
So I would have been 12 or 13.
Sure.
And like you don't want to be associated with child things at that age. It's like, no, I'm an adult now. You know. And I was just a little too old to want to hear songs like Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious or Just a Spoonful of Sugar. And so I don't have those childhood associations with the movie.
So I'm your first Mary Poppins?
You kind of are. I've seen like last week I watched some of the original. But
yeah.
I have no like emotional childhood sure. connection with it. But I really like your film so much.
Thank you.
So I'm really curious what people seeing it without any preconceptions will think. Because that's kind of where
well,
I was.
It's interesting because I personally have found that even if people have not seen the original, I think they're still terribly moved by this version, and they don't really know why. I think probably the general nostalgic feeling and the spirit of the film represents how people grew up and the kind of films they probably watched growing up. And then there are a lot of people who are diehard fans of the original, and I quite like people like that going into our film because I think they go into it with their arms crossed, sort of wanting to hate it. And they end up really loving it. And I had this one journalist say to me the other day, who's quite a cynical guy, he just said, I honestly went in not wanting to like it at all. I don't like musicals. And I really liked the original as a child, but I don't like watching musicals. And he said, but when I saw you coming out of the clouds, I just started to sob, and I don't know why. That's so awesome for me to hear that. It's just, I kind of like both. I like people who are diehard fans, and I like people who've never seen it before.
Emily Blunt, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too. Well, thank you very much. I love talking to you.
Emily Blunt stars as Mary Poppins in Mary Poppins Returns. It opens tomorrow. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, our guest will be Ben Taub of The New Yorker. He reports that now that ISIS has been driven out of most of Iraq, Iraq is waging a cruel and corrupt campaign of revenge. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, including women and children, are being detained, tortured, killed, or cast out of society, suspected of associating with ISIS. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. I'm Terry Gross.
Now, where would we all like to go on this fine, fine day?
The Royal Dalton Music Hall, please.
What? What's that?
We're on the brink of an adventure, children. Don't spoil it with too many questions. In the nursery, you were never by yourself. There was quite another world upon your shelf.
Hold on!
Where each day crowds make their way upon the sun's descent to a mythical, mystical, never quite logistical tent. Yes, in this dilly-dynamical, simply ceramical Royal Dalton Bowl, there's a cuddly and curious, furry and furious animal watering hole where the monkeys and hummingbirds know the tunes and the words every beast, large and small, loves the very top drawable, always encorable Royal Dalton Music Hall.
Ooh, that one tickled my tail. Nearly there, Mary Poppins.
Yes, in this marvelous, mystical, rather sophistical Royal Dalton Bowl,
there's a lot of birds queuing up, a lot of hams chewing up scenery they swallow whole. There are lots of cats tuning strings,
nightingales in the wings,
waiting for their big drum roll at the simply sensational
standing ovational Royal Dalton Music Hall.
Here we are.
Where's the music hall?
Oh, yes, that. Silly me.